From WXXI News, this is Second Opinion Live on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And I am your host, Evan Dawson. This hour, we're focusing on something that will be of interest to anyone who is taking any kind of medication, supplement, vitamin, a pharmaceutical, a so-called nutraceutical. I assume that's the vast majority of us. In 2014, prescription drug spending in the United States was nearly $374 billion, which was a 13.1% increase in growth just over the previous year, and was the highest level of spending since 2001, according to the IMS Institute for Healthcare Informatics. Well, in the meantime, many organizations estimate the amount of money spent on vitamins and supplements, and while these estimates vary, most are close to about $30 billion. So with all of this money being spent, are we healthier because of what we're putting into our bodies in the way of pharmaceuticals and nutraceuticals? That's what we'll discuss today. We hope you'll join the conversation. If you've got a question about what you're taking or what you're thinking about taking, you can join that conversation. This hour is being produced in association with the national public television show Second Opinion, which is produced by WXXI Public Broadcasting and the University of Rochester Medical Center in Rochester, New York. And today's broadcast is part of the Second Opinion Live webcast series. You can watch this program on the web at secondopinion-tv.org. And you can participate in today's conversation by calling us toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. And for the two people who have already asked about fish oil, I promise we'll get there. Whatever it is you want to ask about, you can do that. Let me welcome our guest in studio today. Dr. Roger Oskvig is here. He's a professor of clinical medicine and a geriatrician at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Oskvig, nice to see you.
Good afternoon.
And Lisa Kouras is here. She is a clinical staff pharmacist at Highland Hospital. And Lisa, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
All right, 844-295-TALK listeners, and special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. It's through their generous support that we can provide you with timely, accurate, and valuable health information. And thank you to our public radio and television supporters who help make shows like this possible. Let's get started. We kind of posed that question to begin with. We're spending a lot more money on pharmaceuticals, nutraceuticals, et cetera. Is that making us healthier? Dr. Oskvig, are we healthier because of this?
We are healthy in developed countries because we have good food and clean water. Clearly, individuals who have medical conditions have pharmaceuticals that are prescribed to try to impact that ailment, whatever it is, to help a person become more functional. The issue with supplements is much more complicated.
We'll be getting to that in just a second. Lisa, what do you think? You think we're healthier as a society in this country because of what we're putting into our bodies?
I would tend to say yes if you're taking care of yourself and putting the right substances into your bodies.
And I guess the question is, what's the right substances? I admit, when I came into this program, I didn't even know how to pronounce nutraceuticals. That's not a term that I was familiar with. Can we get a definition? Is this common? Do you guys use this term all the time, Lisa?
Well, I practice in a hospital pharmacy, and we tend to steer away from
using
nutraceuticals.
I wouldn't think so. That's why, see? And when we talk medical issues on this program, it's not one that comes up a lot. So, Dr. Oskvig, how would you define nutraceuticals?
These are unregulated nutritional supplements. And so these are things that are covered by a federal act that represent themselves as being nutritional supplements and make no claim that they are treating a medical condition, diagnosing a medical condition, or that sort of thing. They, in the United States, are unregulated. They're supposed to identify the products or the components that are in the product. The labeling doesn't necessarily have to be complete or accurate.
What are some examples of nutraceuticals?
Individuals who may take seaweed extract, or you may hear of, super green tomato extract.
All right,
or something.
Forgive me, is this homeopathy? Is homeopathy in this category?
Ooh, homeopathy is actually a defined term. So homeopathy is taking substances to try to make the body more homeopathic. An example of that would be if you have a problem with intractable nausea, and we know Ipecac is a substance that creates nausea. If you dilute it to the point you can become immune to nausea, making the body more homeopathic.
Okay, so a little different, but nutraceuticals then would be, like you said, seaweed extract, things like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Fish oil is what? Is fish oil in that category?
Yeah, fish oil is a nutraceutical.
Okay. And you mentioned that they are not regulated, correct?
In the United States, they're not regulated.
Going back, have they ever been regulated? I guess.
No.
I guess not.
Yeah. The nutritional supplement industry tried for a long time to fall into the regulated category with the FDA, and that never was successful. And so they ultimately went around it going directly to Congress to get themselves exempted from the same sort of regulations that drugs had to go through, and have remained that since.
So it sounds like industry decided, you're not going to regulate us the way the FDA is. We're not going to get sort of reviewed that way. We want an exemption, and we don't want to have to be, I guess, they don't want the regulation, do they?
Well, they don't need it now. They are able to market their products without being regulated.
Because I guess what I'm asking is, if they were regulated, they might not be allowed to exist in some cases. Are they making claims that they can't back up?
The claims are very vague that they're made on their labeling. So it's not that they're going to be treating you or curing you. It's to support immune health or something like that.
So a broad claim,
probably
intentionally broad. But some people would say, but you should still regulate that. You know, I mean, especially, are they really boosting immune health? Is seaweed extract doing this or that? But that goes back many decades now where they're not regulated. And why not? Congress has decided that they have a special category here?
Yes. It's a law in the United States. It's not regulated. Now, if it were able to successfully be a regulated industry, that would mean that it should be a covered benefit under your medical insurance plans. At the present time, these nutritional supplements are not part of covered benefits by medical insurance, and so these are all out-of-pocket expenses by people seeking to feel better.
Is this an example of an industry that gets its way, a big industry that can get its way with Congress because of its size and power?
It now is a big industry that probably would favor not being regulated.
They like not being regulated. Okay, so there's a little history, and we're going to be getting to your phone calls and questions. I see the phone ringing. We'll get to that in just a second, but just a little bit more on the background side. Some questions about trade name drugs versus generics that a lot of people have. And we should probably walk through how a drug is brought to market, what the drug developer and manufacturer kind of have to go through to prove the drug is effective and safe. Because nutraceuticals would be in a different category than a drug that has to be regulated that way, yes?
Yes.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right. So what should we know about how that drug is brought to market to begin with to make sure that we know it's effective, for example?
Well, they do rigorous testing on the prescription drugs before they're brought to market. There's animal testing, then there's human trials. There's different phases of human trials where they test the drugs on healthy individuals and the people that actually have the condition that the drug is made for. And that's the first step in the testing for the prescription drugs.
And when it becomes available as a generic, then, is it the same kind of a process?
No. They have an abbreviated new drug application, so they don't have to go through the same tests. They don't test as vigorously as they do in the original testing phase.
I think a lot of us assume the generic is exactly the same thing as the brand name. It's just a different name. Not exactly right, is it?
Not true.
Okay. So what kind of deviation are we talking about?
So let me start with what Lisa was saying about bringing a drug to market. At the present time, a drug in a new class costs about $2.3 billion in research and development to get approval by the FDA, and then it has patent protection for a period of time. Actually, it may have several patents, patent on the active ingredient, patent on the delivery system, patent on other components related to it. When it nears the end of its patent protection, the FDA then accepts applications for a generic. when one is approved, and I'll get back to that in a little bit, the first generic actually has its own protection for 6 months. So the first generic that comes out has no competition for 6 months before other generics can come forward. The active ingredient of the patent drug is what has to be roughly equivalent in the generic. The patent drug company does not have to reveal its manufacturing process or give up its trade secrets on how it mixes the pill, pounds the pill, what it mixes with it. It has to do just the active chemical that the generic drug company has to figure out how they want to make it into a pill. These fillers and coloring agents and that sort of thing, Lisa knows much more about than I ever will. But part of it is the approval process for all of them has to have an internationally accepted generic name. It's not actually the chemical, which is usually 72 characters long, but something that all of them get known by, like atorvastatin. All of those cholesterol equivalents will have to use atorvastatin as a generic, but all of the generics will have to have their own trade name. And the pill that's made has to look different from the patent drug. So it can't be confused as being the patent drug. Its equivalence, as Lisa was saying, has to be tested on 25 or so healthy individuals to see that the drug that arrives in the bloodstream arrives there about the same time and about the same levels as the patent drug in what's called 90% confidence interval, which means you can have as much as a 20% difference from the trade drug, which the industry internationally has said isn't that meaningful in terms of the drug being okay.
Can we end up with the generics causing different side effects or different effects in a person than the non-generic?
More often, if it's a drug that has something called a narrow therapeutic index, so if the drug is very specific and it affects certain areas specifically, then at times you could have differences in the way that you feel after taking a certain medication if you're changed from the brand name to the generic or whatnot. Those are commonly like anti-seizure drugs and warfarin, which is commonly taken by many people, digoxin, levothyroxine. So you can notice things like that more when you're switched from a brand to generic or a generic to a different generic.
That's why I think this background is helpful to people, because I think that assumption that the generic is essentially the same. Do you find some patients who are surprised that there could be different impacts, different side effects?
Definitely. Yeah. I think that when you're working in the retail world and a patient comes in and you're giving them a new prescription, they notice only if it looks different. So if the patient gets a pill that's white originally and round, and they get another white round one, they're not going to think to themselves something might be different. But if they get a new pill that's pink, they could say to themselves, oh, this is a new drug, and maybe might start to ask questions to the pharmacist.
Okay. And again, to stress the point, the generic does by law have to look different, right?
That's correct.
All right, so at least that's probably a good thing, because it would prompt those questions.
Right, yeah.
Okay. I want to start taking your phone calls. If you've got questions about, you know, we're kind of talking about drugs, we're talking about nutraceuticals. I threw homeopathy into the mix, which there's all kinds of things that we spend money on that are in our medicine cabinets. If you've got those questions, this is the time to do it. 844-295-TALK. I'm going to start with Chris in Palmyra. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. Are you? If you're there, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes. Do you have a question?
Oh, excellent. Actually, I have a comment.
Okay.
I am a practicing herbalist, and I just wanted to say that for many of us who practice herbalism and work with people, we always talk to our patients, our clients, because we do not diagnose and we do not prescribe. But we tell our clients the foundation of good health is always a healthy diet, appropriate exercise, and getting enough sleep. All the supplements in the world are not going to do you any good if you continue to live in an unhealthy way. And we know that some supplements are effective. Red rice yeast can be effective in lowering cholesterol, but it has to be combined with diet and exercise. And before I ever recommend any type of an herbal supplement, I always make sure I go over in detail with my clients what medications they're taking. And I tell them, you never stop taking any medication and start taking an herbal supplement without consulting with your doctor. It is absolutely essential that doctors work with their patients and educate them about if they're going to use a supplement, they have to do so safely. Just to go out to the store and buy something because you heard about it can be dangerous.
So, Chris, you say you're an herbalist, and again, if you could just sort of define that term for the audience who may not be familiar with it.
I work with clients who are interested in adding herbs to their diet, and these are, for the most part, food-grade herbs, such as thyme, sage, St. John's wort, red rice yeast, and many others, some of which you can grow in your own garden, which we use for culinary purposes as well. I will prepare these herbs, perhaps as a tincture in either an alcohol or a vinegar base. I might prepare it in a water base as a tea. One of our most popular remedies is actually a ginger tea to treat nausea, especially related to motion sickness.
Okay, and so Chris, I'm somebody who I love anything that can make us healthier and stronger. I'm also a skeptic who loves evidence and sort of science-based, science-informed decision-making. So when you are recommending, whatever it is you're recommending to people, is it based in scientific evidence, study, and trial?
To some degree, yes. There have been studies in Europe which have been done which have indicated that the efficacy of certain herbs, such as valerian and passion flower, passiflora, for encouraging restful sleep. Studies done on the use of lavender for promoting effective sleep on ginger and peppermint for the use of settling a stomach. Again, like I said, the red rice yeast for lowering cholesterol. Others of it are based on traditional uses. And I guess when I'm working with somebody, if they want to work with something that has a traditional use, I will encourage them to keep careful note of what they are taking, how much they are taking, and what types of symptom relief they are finding. Just like any other medication that we might take, herbs do not always work the same way for all people. Some people have wonderful results, some people less so.
Okay, and Chris, before I let you go here, again, I am ignorant on so many of these terms. Is what you are doing, is this in the world of homeopathy? Is this in what we would call nutraceuticals or something else?
No, herbalism is pretty much a study onto its own. Homeopathy, I am familiar with the use of homeopathy. I have used some homeopathic remedies myself, and I know many people who use them. I really can't explain if they work, how they work, and I remain a little skeptical about the use of homeopathy myself.
Okay, well, Chris, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate the background. And Dr. Osvig, when it comes to herbalism, again, that's another term. She's saying it's kind of a separate category. Does that technically fall into a nutraceutical or something else?
No, this is really a nutrient of sorts. We know things like she mentioned ginger. Ginger is a substance that, as a matter of fact, has active ingredients in terms of the way that our GI tract metabolizes, the way it releases bicarb from the pancreas and that sort of thing. So it's part of, if you will, food.
So when mom prescribes ginger ale to settle a stomach when you're not feeling well, there may actually be some science backing, or at least a reason?
Yeah, as long as the ginger ale has ginger in it.
Okay, right. Probably has a lot of sugar in it.
And there's a lot of flavorings that can make things taste like ginger. Uh-huh. Yeah. And there are caramelizing sugars to make it look like gingered water and that sort of thing. It's knowing what's in there.
But that's probably based, though, on the idea, though, that ginger, real ginger, does have an impact that you're talking about.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Before I move to our next call, any other thoughts on what we heard? So there's herbalism. And Chris in Palmyra, thanks for the phone call. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI. If you want to call Second Opinion Live, 263-9994. In Chilai, this is Bud. Go ahead, Bud.
Hi. Great program. I have been taking for several years to help sleep diphenhydramine. It was originally being marketed as an antihistamine, but it was always said would make you drowsy. And then we found out that when we took NyQuil, we slept better. So I reasoned I could try it, and it helped. But more recently, I've added melatonin. And here's where it gets really interesting. My wife's doctor says those act counter to each other, and she shouldn't take them. Whereas my doctor, who's an older guy, has never been upset with either of them. Now, what is going on here?
Bud, stay on the line here. Melatonin, I've heard as well often, but we'll ask our guests to weigh in.
Okay, so melatonin is going to be a nutraceutical. It's not going to be a regulated drug stocked by Lisa's Pharmacy. There is literature that shows that melatonin can cycle people's sleep more normally. So if you have a disruption in your sleep-awake cycle, you're sleepy during the day and you can't get to sleep at night, it can help move that. It's been used a lot by individuals who do a lot of international traveling to try to adjust their sleep to fit with where they arrive. To deal with jet lag.
Okay.
And it's been shown to be helpful in speeding up getting your day-night cycle fixed with where you land.
Okay.
We have actually just added melatonin to our formulary recently.
Ooh, okay.
There's a number of people that use that medicine and claim that it works very well, and it's actually a good alternative to some other choices for sleep. They're controlled substances and addictive, so we did actually recently add melatonin.
How about the diphenhydramine?
For every night use?
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to harm you per se, but I mean, I guess that you try to figure out what's really the issue, and if you could help to develop better sleep patterns or try to do things differently before you go to sleep. Diphenhydramine, you just got to be careful if you're drinking, because if you would drink alcohol and have diphenhydramine, there could be additive effects, so you just got to be careful how you use it.
Okay. Well, thank you. It is very confusing, because both of them now are being sold as sleep aids, and I think a lot of people say, well, one is good, why not both? And so there you go. Thank you.
There's nothing that's necessarily interactive about using the two together. They have two different types of actions. The caution with diphenhydramine is it gets more and more problematic the older you get. It can really lead to daytime confusion that looks like dementia.
Here is a comment from a listener named Jake, and he writes, with supplements that have been tested, I hope your guests can comment on the fact that many that have shown positive results have never had follow-up studies done to determine the mechanism of action. The public often jumps the gun on every new study that comes out before the causal relationship has been found, and also tends to overgeneralize and amplify study results for their specific condition. Test groups are seldom large enough to generalize results to the overall population and may adversely affect specific medical conditions that are not well represented in study groups, further exacerbating negative effects to compounds that may have little to no practical effect. I wonder how many sick people are sicker from overuse over any even theoretical benefits to the population at large. What do you guys think?
He should be the third guest on your show.
You want to elaborate on that? Is he making a valid point here?
Yeah, he is making a valid point. When you're comparing the results of experience with small numbers of people on very focused conditions and then trying to generalize that to large things. It even applies to patent drugs. When they're initially being tested and marketed, there's a very careful selection of individuals with the condition you're trying to manage. You know, if you are developing a new drug for asthma, you want the population you're testing it on to be pretty purely asthmatics and not have thyroid disease and cholesterol problems and other things like that. And it gets marketed because it's really good for asthma. It then gets given to individuals who are taking lots of other pills and potions and have other things. And the behavior of this medicine now, when it's mixed with a larger segment, we suddenly may find unanticipated problems.
Okay. Well, on that note, let's take a short break, and when we come back here, we're going to answer more of your questions, and I'll try to move as quickly as I can through. We've had questions on vitamin D, fish oil, all kinds of other things. If you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Short break, and more Second Opinion Live next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, you've probably seen the news out of North Carolina about their governor and legislature passing a bill that has been viewed as anti-LGBT. We're going to talk about why and the impact of that kind of legislation, even though it's a North Carolina state bill. What's the impact nationwide on the LGBT community? Talk with you Monday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Eastman School of Music, presenting the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, performing Bach and Shostakovich, featuring Peter Ungen conducting and Angela Hewitt on piano, Friday, April 15th at Kodak Hall at Eastman Theater. Tickets at eastmantheater.org.
Welcome back to Second Opinion Live and Connections on this Friday afternoon. I'm Evan Dawson, and this program is being produced in association with the National Public Television show Second Opinion. Today's broadcast, part of the Second Opinion Live webcast series. Our guests in studio today are Dr. Roger Osvig, professor of clinical medicine and a geriatrician at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and Lisa Kuros, clinical staff pharmacist at Highland Hospital. Thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, their support helps to make Second Opinion Live possible. You can watch the program on the web at secondopinion-tv.org, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or join us via Twitter using the hashtag 2NDOP, 2NDOP. All right, working through some of our various guest comments and questions about products here, fish oil. Had a couple of those before the program even began. What do we know about fish oil? What's the evidence for fish oil? You see a lot of people taking it. Yes or
no? Okay. The short answer is not much. There's no question that eating wild cold water fish has health benefits. The natives in those populations have done it. It was assumed that it was related to the oils that are in the fish. The challenge is the oil itself. Fish are a natural product, and it's probably more than just the oil that we squeeze out of their flesh that's part of the health benefit. The tocopherols that are in fish, gamma cortoferol is probably the effective vitamin E that's in fish, not the sort of thing that you get as a supplement in the store. The fish oil itself is rapidly oxidized by air, and so the active ingredient deteriorates rapidly. If you do fish oil, there's two things. It should be fresh, it should be kept refrigerated, and you should burp fish oil, fish smell, if you're taking enough.
Well, that's specific enough for you. Two of us in the room winced when Dr. Osvig said that, but that's actually helpful to know there. Vitamin D. A lot of questions about vitamin D. You want to hit that one, Lisa?
Vitamin D. There's been a lot of talk about women especially using enough vitamin D lately. I think that it's not anything that's going to hurt anyone, but I think that all of these vitamins, we have to know that most of us will get the majority that we need in our diets. So it's a secondary sort of thing that you want to try to get it in your diet more before you're using these supplements to get it.
Okay. Essentially, every vitamin study that's been carefully looked at either shows in normal individuals like us the vitamins are ineffective or potentially harmful. When you get the vitamin from a food, there's no question that it's beneficial.
Well said. Vitamin D deficiency, what should we be concerned about? People who are vitamin D deficient, what's the impact?
Okay, so that's much more complicated. We know that vitamin D levels are associated with things like dementia, the risk of getting cancers, and that sort of thing. What we don't have is reliable evidence that supplementing with vitamin D changes that. So if we take an individual who's got low vitamin D and we give them large doses of vitamin D, do we change the risk of getting dementia or cancer or colon polyps or that sort of thing? And the answer to that is no.
Okay. Do we know how much sunshine we would need to be not vitamin D deficient?
Yeah. Between April and October, about 20 minutes of midday sun 3 times a week.
20 minutes 3 times a week?
Yeah.
That's like nothing.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, I mean, we are a pretty sentient indoor society now, but for those of you who like to be outside, that's so most of us, we're doing fine.
Most of us could.
Or could be doing fine. Okay.
Yeah.
And one more quick question before we get back to the phone calls. When it comes to expiration dates, we had a conversation recently on this program about food waste and how even in food, expiration dates are hit and miss as to whether they're really even valid. Sometimes they're really, really, I think, overprotective. And I say overprotective. I mean, overprotective of anyone who'd be eating the food. But for, you know, for a world that throws away roughly a third of the food that's ever made, I think we are too aggressive with expiration dates based on what I have read on food. I don't know about drugs, pharmaceuticals, et cetera. How concerned do we need to be about whatever's in our medicine cabinet and those expiration dates?
I would go by what they tell you.
You would?
Yes, because there were studies, again, done on all these medications to get to the expiration date that they're at. Once they're out of their original packaging, things change, especially prescriptions that you're getting. So I would pretty much follow those. I mean, obviously, if something is needed to be taken and you have something that's expired a month, maybe you consider doing it, but most of the time I would stick to what they say.
Okay, and if you took something that is, you know, past its expiration date, is it more likely to simply be less effective or to be actually harmful?
More likely to be less effective. There's only probably a few drugs that'll start harming you if you do that, but...
But don't necessarily expect the same impact if you're taking it past the expiration.
Right.
Okay. Certainly very helpful. Let me get back to the phones. Richard in Liverpool, New York. Go ahead, Richard.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
How are you today?
Good. Very good. Thanks.
Good. Well, the topic is excellent. I think it's very important for the public to understand this. My personal comment is just a suggestion. Dr. Paul Offit wrote a book last year, which I read. I thought he was brilliant in the way he explain the history of medicine and the role that supplements and you know, pharmaceuticals, how they've co-evolved and morphed over the years. And it's a book called Do You Believe in Magic? I'm sure your guests have heard of the book or perhaps even read it. They sound very knowledgeable. And whenever I'm approached by a person who has this or that homeopathic remedy, I always tell them either it's medicine or it's not medicine. Either proven to be effective and safe, or it's not proven to be effective and safe. And to put my mother's words, she's 94 years old, very healthy. She says, if my doctor doesn't tell me to take it, I'm not taking it. So I'll leave you with that, the wisdom of a 94-year-old woman who is never to be found, always out and about.
Well, thank you, Richard. Thanks for the phone call. Good advice, I guess. Yeah, Dr. Asvig, yeah.
Yeah. you know, I think pharmaceutical drugs are chemicals put in the body to accomplish a task. Some of them intentionally cause harm to do good. Chemotherapy kills cancer cells.
Yeah.
It is put in the body to do harm to do good.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And it's a whole other program. But are we ever going to have a cancer treatment that can only target, cannot have the sort of collateral damage of that chemo has on the healthy tissue? But that is a whole other show. Karen in Rochester, next up on Second Opinion Live. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi, I have a question. In my body, NyQuil and like Tylenol PM, they have the opposite effect. Anything like that, it kind of buzzes. So would you suggest like a homeopathic remedy for like sleeping?
You're saying NyQuil has the opposite effect on you?
Yes. Sometimes like Tylenol PM and NyQuil and things like that, it has the opposite effect. It doesn't make me sleepy at all.
Karen, thank you for the phone call. It's a very interesting question. Lisa, what do you think?
Yeah, the science behind that is probably not there. It's just that it happens to some people.
More
some people
anecdotally
take,
than scientifically?
Yeah, I think so. Some people take a drug that's supposed to cause one thing to happen, and it causes the opposite. For somebody like that, as far as sleep patterns, we talked about melatonin earlier. There's somewhere where maybe somebody can try to do that. But there's also, obviously, a lot of different things, like I said, but turning off the lights at a certain time. There's a lot of these different things that you read about for people that have trouble sleeping to try before they try an herbal or any kind of medicine.
Let me give you an asking for a friend question then, Lisa.
Yeah.
Let's just say, hypothetically, there was a couple that had a toddler and they were flying to Europe and they were wondering, little Benadryl for a toddler, is that okay for the flight to kind of... You know, you hear parents doing that on long flights.
It's true, but they changed the dosing regulations or recommendations, I should say, on Benadryl, and now they don't want you to use it in children like 3 years old and whatnot. So if you were going to do it, I'd definitely ask the doctor beforehand just to get the right dose and whatnot
right dose.
For the child.
Okay, and could that produce the opposite effect? Could that spike a child's energy?
It could.
It could.
It could.
I guess anecdotally, but okay, so... Okay, see, parents have been warned there. let me get in Rochester. This is Deborah next up. Go ahead, Deborah.
Yes, hi. I'm questioning the validity or necessity of the omega-3s from fish oil. It was my understanding that the fish actually get the omega-3s. They don't synthesize it themselves, and they get it from algae. And given that... our waters are so polluted such that there's a high mercury content and probably other toxic chemicals in fish, never mind the fact that, we're overfishing and, destroying our natural fisheries. I would think that, we should be getting our omegas from other sources. I know... I've taken a product called algae omega that's on the market. I just was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Deborah, thanks for the phone call. Dr. Askvig.
She brings up a lot of valid points. The fats that are in fish and other species like that are a product of what they eat and how their systems metabolize it as well. The plant sources of a lot of our nutrients also can be complicated. You know, we can take something simple like glycogen. In animal species, it looks like an onion. It's sort of round. In plants, it looks like a 2x4. It's linear, and so we even metabolize sugars differently. Still, the evidence is... from research in nutritional studies that eating fish 3 times a month, something only the size of a deck of cards, is associated with health.
Let me get back to your phone calls, and we'll mention we got about 15 minutes left in the program. If you want to call Second Opinion Live, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Let's go down to Honeyoy, and this is Clark next up. Go ahead, Clark.
Hello there. I heard someone answered a question about vitamins with the announcement that, well, with your diet, you probably get all your vitamins in your diet. The question is, in the entire Monroe County, multiple areas, and the East Coast and West Coast, and entire all the people that I know in the United States, there are only two that eat according to the dietary recommendations. So therefore, what about vitamins for the 99% of the rest of us who have that burger from McDonald's or that cup of soup that is made with God knows what?
No, I know, I'm with you, but isn't the first step just saying less McDonald's is a valuable goal, Clark?
Well, the ideal is to eat proper foods all day long, proper size breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But as I said, I don't know anyone who does that, and I'm not going to be eating 3 meals of green stuff all day long just on the off chance that I'm going to be healthy. I want to take a vitamin so I know I'm covered. I want to take vitamin D to know I'm covered. I want to take fish oil to know I'm covered.
Sure, absolutely. And Clark, thanks for the phone call. I say this knowing that I am like anybody else who hits a drive-through in a pinch, or you know, you're having a rough day, or you're stuck at the office. But there's something a little defeatist to saying, well, there's nothing we can really, we're not going to change from the fast food society. I mean, at some point, I think we've got to try to get a little bit more control over the quality of the food that we eat. But Clark is right. I mean, there's a lot of people who are probably not going to make those changes, and they're wondering, well, okay, why not a vitamin? Why not this, that, et cetera? I'll let our guests respond to what they just heard. Go ahead, Dr. Ostfig.
I'll start with the food component. Highly processed foods have a tendency to damage or remove the nutrients that are part of the source thing. And so there's a lot of literature now that talks about eating food as close to the source as you can. The second thing with regard to food is our body averages it. There's nothing physiologic built into humans that says we need to be eating 3 or 6 meals a day. Several hundred years ago, people were often eating once every other day. And so our nutrient intake actually gets averaged over weeks. And so there's nothing about needing a certain amount of vitamin D or vitamin B or vitamin C every day. It's that our body gets it at intervals that allows it to metabolize normally, so we don't get scurvy and beriberi and things like that. The vitamins itself is a more complicated thing because the vitamins aren't an it. Lisa knows much more about, you know, there are all sorts of ratios that are marketed as representing the perfect balance eyes or ears or toenails or whatever.
You want to weigh in on some of Clark's points there? I mean, you know, I think what he's trying to do is make sure that if he's not getting it through food, he's getting it through a supplement or a pill form.
If somebody personally asked me if they could take a multivitamin and they think that it would make them feel better and help them, I have no reason to tell them not to take it. I would be fine saying that it's okay to take. The whole thing that came up was that recently there was all these studies done that said that taking a multivitamin doesn't have an added benefit. But if it's going to make the person feel better, then take it.
You mean the power of placebo is amazing?
Yep.
Okay. But getting it through food is always a much better idea, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the studies show if you get your nutrients through food, there's something more than just what we think the it of the item in the food, you know, the vitamin C in the orange. There's more there that confers this overall benefit.
Well, I wonder what people like Clark would think of. What was the product? Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, young 20-somethings, Soylent. It was, they named a product cheekily after Soylent Green, Charlton Heston movie. Have you seen the product? I think they're millionaires now. They wanted to create a product that you wouldn't have to eat any food because preparing food takes time. Food costs money. It's a pain. So now you can order Soylent, and I think it's still on the market. And the New York Times did an interesting taste test of this with a sommelier and a gastroenterologist. But Soylent is, it's sort of a little powder. You put it with a little water, and it's kind of a gray slurry. And you've got to drink it 3 times a day, and you're supposed to get 100% of all of the vitamins, minerals, whatever nutrients that you need without ever having to eat. Not sure long-term how that would work.
Not heard of that.
You have not heard of it,
no.
Dr. Ostfig?
I have. Well, you know, and that assumed that we know 100% of everything that we need and that there's nothing that we haven't studied that's needed.
Sure. Okay. Well, that'll be I hope they do a long-term study on Soylent. Let's go out to Syracuse. This is Thomas next up. Go ahead, Thomas.
Hi. I was just calling in to try to get your guys' take on probiotics and the research that's coming out, going on, and, you know, potential harms and benefits that the public needs to worry about.
I'll do one take, and then Lisa can talk about what's actually dispensed in hospital. We have probably at least 1 million different organisms in our GI tract. The challenge with general probiotics is assuming that the one lactobacillus or the one Saccharomyces is the single organism our gut needs to be normal again. And so that's a little bit of the challenge of probiotics. Having said that, foods have lots of stuff. The lettuce we eat has lots of stuff on it, and the carrots we chew on has all the stuff in the soil that came along with it that we had. And so we take probiotics all the time in the foods that we take that we don't sterilize before we eat. Probiotics are used medically.
I haven't heard of too many people having trouble, like, side effect-wise from taking probiotics. We have quite a few people that come into the hospital and they are prescribed them or they're coming in on them. I don't know. I don't think that there's too many issues as far as bad things coming from them. I mean, you see Activia and these yogurts that are on the market now, and they have all of them in there too. So I don't think it's a harmful thing. I think it might help people that need it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. Thanks for the phone call. A listener just wrote to the program informing me that Soylent is advertising on podcasts now, so it's the Soylent Revolution. We'll see where it goes next. I also had a comment from a parent about the pressure on young athletes and the question on kids and bodybuilding and whey protein and things like that. And I wanted to ask Dr. Osvig about the various sort of sports supplement world, nutrition bars, whey protein, all of these. And we can kind of take it step by step. But to the parent who asked about whey protein, I have read that, and I'm a big smoothie maker at home, I had read that buying whey protein, the powdered kind, can be harder to digest. That might just be a warning that it's a little bit of a stopper. I don't know. But what do we think about whey protein?
Well, whey as a protein is a good amino acid balance for humans. So if you're going to take a protein, you're going to pick something, whey can be the it that gives you roughly the balance that you should have. Like a lot of these powdered things, they turn into goo in the gut. And so if you aren't well hydrated, then you have that slosh full feeling in your stomach. Sports nutrition bars are a trick of advertising. These are candy bars that have fiber put in it, which allows them to be marketed as sports bars, to which they have to add additional sugars to make them palatable.
So they're just candy bars?
They're just candy bars with more fiber.
Okay. So if you want a candy bar, eat a candy bar.
Eat a candy bar. And a lot of them, the candy bars add some stuff. We'll put some fresh cherries in it or have some more dark chocolate or that sort of thing, which have some health benefit. But, by and large, sports bars are candy bars.
And, I'm sure parents have been asking about sports drinks for a long time, whether it's sugar, electrolytes, et cetera. What do we need for optimal athletic performance and recovery?
Water. Yeah. I mean, if you're talking about the usual exercise that people do for sports, what do you need to perform well? Water. You have adequate glycogen stores to do continuous exercise for 2 hours before you start needing any other nutrient. And so short of running a marathon in 2 hours or that sort of thing, what do you need to run a marathon? Water.
Now, what do you know about running marathons? I mean, I hear a rumor that you've got a family member who's one of the great ultra-marathoners in the country. Is that true?
My son, Davin, was the number one ranked ultra-marathoner in North America last fall.
That is incredible. Wow. Congratulations to him. That is really amazing. So, but you hear the father of one of the top ultra-marathoners saying, most of that high-marketed stuff, throw it out the window. So something to keep in mind, especially for parents feeling a lot of pressure with their kids in athletics. One more quick phone call. David and Hector, keep it to 30 seconds or less. Go ahead, David.
Hi. Can you tell me how I can be assured that there's no gluten in any of my medications?
The inactive ingredients should be listed any time that you get a new medication. They should be in the pamphlet that you get from the drugstore or from an over-the-counter medication. So it should be listed right in there if it contains anything like that.
Okay. Is that a common question, Lisa?
I think now that it seems that there's more people that are having intolerances with gluten, so it's coming up more often, yeah.
And it's a whole other hour itself is a question on gluten. And the difference between a gluten allergy, a gluten sensitivity, a gluten intolerance, I don't know, Dr. Osvig, do you want to weigh in? Are we overdoing it with gluten sensitivity? Are we thinking ourselves into it, or is that a legitimate society concern right now?
Gluten allergy is a real phenomenon. Those individuals need to avoid it because that allergy injures the gut. There are a lot of individuals who are uncomfortable eating gluten. That's not an allergy, and it's not a health hazard.
It's not a health hazard.
No.
But if you're uncomfortable, should you just eat less of it, I guess?
Yeah. You know?
Sure, right?
Yeah, sure.
But medically...
It's a food preference,
okay,
then.
It's a preference. Okay. Well, we've covered a lot of ground, and how about some very, really brief closing thoughts about making sure that you're empowered to understand whatever it is that you're taking? You just mentioned read the label.
Well, if you can't find it, too, you can always ask your pharmacist at the store. I mean, you're in there, and they'll talk to you and help you to decide if something's right for you, if it contains an ingredient. I think there's something to be said about a pharmacist and patient interaction.
Well said. And Dr. Osvig?
Same sort of thing. Talk to your pharmacist. They also are incredibly knowledgeable about food-drug interaction and can give a lot of advice about the over-the-counter medications that are also carried and how they might affect the medicines they're taking.
I want to thank our guests for being here and answering a wide range of questions, probably wider than we even thought when we came here, but that's what always happens with Second Opinion Live. Our audience interaction drives the program, so our thanks to Lisa Kuros, the clinical staff pharmacist at Highland Hospital. Thanks for being here this hour.
Thank you.
And Dr. Roger Osvig, professor of clinical medicine and geriatrician at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thank you, Dr. Osvig.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Second Opinion Live. Thank you to our sponsor, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. Their support helping to make today's program possible. And thanks to all of you listening on WXXI 1370, down in the Finger Lakes on WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM, watching on secondopinion-tv.org. I'm Evan Dawson. Our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer of the broadcast, and Megan Mack, the producer, and the whole team at Second Opinion Live. Have a great weekend. We'll talk with you Monday.